From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a young woman wants to know what it feels like to be a woman living outside the law. So she starts a creative writing program at the Women's Detention Facility on Rikers Island. We talk with Carol Muskie Dukes, the author of the new novel Channeling Mark Twain. It's based on her experiences in the 70s starting a writing program for women at Rikers. Muskie Dukes also founded the graduate program in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. Also, Brian Ferry sings Bob Dylan, an unlikely-sounding choice for the singer who started with Roxy Music, dresses in high fashion, and likes to croon romantic old pop tunes. We'll talk with Ferry about his new album, Dylan-esque. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Carol Muskie Dukes, has written a novel about an idealistic woman in the 1970s who starts a creative writing program for inmates at the women's detention house on Rikers Island. The novel is based on Muskie Dukes' own experiences when she started a writing program at Rikers. The novel is called Channeling Mark Twain. The title refers to an inmate who believes she's the illegitimate great-granddaughter of Mark Twain. Muskie Dukes is the founder of the graduate program in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California and also teaches at Columbia. She's the author of two other novels and seven poetry collections, one of which was a National Book Award finalist. She's also a former poetry columnist for the LA Times Book Review. Channeling Mark Twain is not only about the idealistic teacher and the inmates she teaches, it's about the pimps who have a business interest in the inmates. Here's a reading from the opening of the novel.
The pimps got on the bus at the stop just before the end of the line. The end of the line was Rikers Island, and the stop before was just at the foot of a very long bridge. I'd read somewhere that the Rikers Island Bridge was over 5,000 feet long, and before it was built, the only way to reach the island was by ferry boat. Now the bridge connected the island with the city, but the largest penal colony in the United States was still remote. But not so remote, I wrote in my notebook, that pimps couldn't manage to slouch out past the great glittering skyline, hats on their heads, to haul in their booty. We were all riding the Hazen Street bus, which stopped daily in front of Bloomingdale's in Manhattan, where I got on, then crossed the 59th Street Bridge and trundled out through Queens all the way to the foot of that mile-long span. Cars were not allowed on the island, only corrections vans, work vehicles, and prison shuttles, which looked like golf carts, and the daily bus. As we crossed the bridge, planes skidded through the clouds above us, above the flat-topped cell block buildings, 9 jails for men, 1 for women.
That's Carol Muskie Dukes reading from her new novel, Channeling Mark Twain. Carol, why did you include pimps in the opening scene, riding to Rikers Island?
Well, you know, I tried to write about this novel is somewhat autobiographical, and I had tried to write about the experience of teaching poetry in prison for a long time, and I could never quite find a way in to the experience. And I finally realized I had to just dive in to what was the hardest thing to write about, the thing I least wanted to write about, which was the reality of the life, that is to say, capital T, capital L, that most of the women in prison, most of the women at the women's house, many of them anyway, were prostitutes, and many of them lived the life and gave all their money to pimps, and the pimps were, although not in the prison, obviously, were outside of the prison, were very much present. And so I just decided to confront it head on.
What were some of the crimes that the women on Rikers were there for? And it's a detention facility. So, you know, for a lot of the women, they weren't even charged yet. Like, why were the women you were working with there?
Most of the women I was working with were there for what are called more or less victimless crimes. That is to say, they either had been charged or had not been charged. They were being detained or they would ultimately be sentenced for victimless crimes like prostitution, drugs, even shoplifting. However, it was true then, and I think still is somewhat true, that women's crime, in quotes, would jump. In other words, from prostitution, drugs, shoplifting, to murder. There would be very little middle crime, you know, burglary, grand larceny, knocking over the 7-Eleven, that kind of thing. Women would either, as I say in the novel, they'd be charged for, you know, stealing a Twinkie or shooting the pimp's head off.
Well, I want you to read one of the poems that one of the women writes in your novel. And this is a woman who's charged with a violent crime. And the poem is called My Face. Tell us, like, who writes this in the novel and then read it to us.
The woman who writes it in the novel is named Sally Keller, and she is a woman who is waiting to be charged with homicide. She has killed her pimp, and she has been with this pimp for many, many, many years. I should also say that for prostitutes and pimps, there's a sort of transactional agreement that the worst thing that can happen, or the worst, most indictable, reprehensible thing that can happen between the pimp and the prostitute is that the prostitute will hold out money from the pimp, hold something back, and if the pimp finds out about it, he takes a revenge, usually a physical revenge, that is to say, some sort of bodily harm or even death on the prostitute.
Now, before you read this, you should describe that the character in the novel who's based on you, when she first meets this woman, is just appalled at how she looks. Describe how she looks.
Yes, the main character, whose name is Holly Maddox, who is a young woman, a young poet who has come in to teach poetry in the prisons. On the first class meeting, the women come into a classroom at the prison, and she greets them all. And finally, the last woman to come in is Sally Keller, who is shocking. And she's shocking in appearance because her face looks like a cubist baseball. It looks like a hot dog split open on a grill. Something very awful has happened to her face, and her eyes are on two different levels. And Holly Maddox, the main character, the narrator, can barely look at her and yet can't stop looking at her.
So here's the poem that the woman with the horrible face writes.
My face. You ask how I got this face, and I say I got this face by having a mind to stand up to the bloodsucker, took my body, took my arms and legs, breasts and tongue, my pretty hair, sold them all to bad 10 years and cheat me straight up. And when I took my own body back from him and all he stole, he come looking for me. And when he show up and find me, he bend a hanger straight, heat the wire white, tie me up in front of my baby son so he could get see how my face open up by that wire. He slice all ways, rip side, rip back, rip slash over my nose bone and up. So he say, you never look good to no man again. And so right, I look no good to him that other day when I shot him once, then got the gun up under his chin. Slick, I say, better smile one last for me, 'cause now you get to have a new face too.
Is this character based on a real woman who you taught at the detention center? And is this poem based on a real poem that was written?
This character is based on a composite, really, of a couple of women whose faces were scarred very badly, who were in my class, in the workshop at the Women's House of Detention. And after a long period of time, after we all knew each other pretty well, it came out that they had been scarred. They had been, their faces had been cut in this way by pimps. I don't want to call it a technique, but this custom of bending a hanger and then heating it and then using it as a kind of surgical device to just completely damage the face and the appearance of the face was apparently pretty common.
And what about the poem? Did somebody write a poem like this in your class?
Actually, I had to make, this was a very hard job for me to make up the poems because, you know, there were poems that were about these kinds of things, but I obviously couldn't. And I actually had put together a little anthology at one point of some of the poems that the women had written. And so I, you know, they were still in my mind and I could still read them, but I didn't want to, of course, take the words of the women. So I had to write my own poems, but in their voices, that is to say, or try to get close to the sound of their voices. So this is my poem, and yet I, you know, tried to remember some of the things that were said and some of the other poems that were circulating, you know, that had bits and pieces of this experience and put them together into my single voice.
So when you met women who had, like, shot their pimp or shot someone else, were you shocked by that? And did you find it hard to relate to them once you knew what they had done?
I didn't, because, you know, the experience of meeting those pimps, they did stand outside the reception center at Rikers Island, and I very quickly got a sense of what they were like. And then, of course, the women talked about them a lot or off and on, I got a sense of them as absolutely ruthless, that the women meant less than nothing to them. And usually they strung the women out on drugs so that the women would be essentially slaves. They'd be enslaved to the drug habit and then enslaved thus to the pimp. So I don't think I was shocked. I think that, you know, I just didn't feel sympathy for the pimps and when they got what they essentially deserved. The novel is to a large degree, or I hope it is, about justice. And justice being what it is, very contradictory in its application, one gets a sense in prison of justice, a sense of justice having been taken into somebody's hands. And that's what the feeling I got from these women often. Not that it's right to kill people, but that when it came down to, for example, a woman who had been beaten for 15 years by her husband and suddenly walked into church and God spoke to her, she heard a voice telling her that she should shoot her husband, I could understand that rather than be shocked by it.
My guest is Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new novel is called Channeling Mark Twain. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet and novelist Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new novel, Channeling Mark Twain, is based on her experiences in 1975 when she founded a creative writing program at the Women's Detention House on Rikers Island. What are some of the things that you learned by teaching at the Women's Detention Facility on Rikers Island that you don't think you otherwise would have learned?
I learned that people wrote, and I know this is going to sound really dramatic, but people wrote to stay sane, they wrote to keep alive. I have not since then encountered a need to write so fierce that simply getting words on paper was a way of keeping oneself whole. That was a huge thing for me to understand, a difficult thing for me to understand. And when I understood it, it moved me so much. It moved me emotionally and it educated me as a teacher. It allowed me to see that expression is truly a lifeline. I hadn't understood that before. Now I understand that, you know, no matter how you teach, that's true, or where you teach, that's true. But it was really the women at the Women's House of Detention who helped me to understand that.
So what do you think was so life-saving to the women who you taught in the detention facility about writing?
Well, I think that they could lie, for one thing. Writing is not always about, obviously, the truth. What is the truth? I think that writers of memoir get into trouble often because remembering and imagining, to a large degree, are the same thing. And so they were allowed to make up stuff about themselves. And making up stuff about themselves provided this larger emotional truth, which is aesthetic truth, which is the truth of the poem or the truth of the story. And that was profoundly freeing for them once they saw that they could do that, you know, that it was okay. They didn't have to sort of recite their charges or talk about their failures. They could somehow talk about their lives in a way that made them more alive to themselves.
If you had gone into, say, an inner-city public school and tried to teach poetry, I'm not sure you would have had a great reception initially, because it's really hard for any new teacher in a school, in a public school in a tough neighborhood, to get past the period where they're challenged by all the students. Did you have to go through anything like that in a detention facility? I mean, the people are forced to be there, and here you are coming in from the outside, you know, wanting to give them something, and in this case, give them, you know, poetry and writing.
Yeah, I have gone into inner city schools. USC sits, like a few universities, Columbia, Yale, in the middle of what is called a, you know, difficult socioeconomic area. And there's something called the Neighborhood Academic Initiative. I've gone into, you know, grade schools, high schools, and taught students there. And it is very hard. It's everything you say. It's much harder in a way, or much more challenging at first. When I went into the prisons, I was kind of amazed by the fact that the women were so responsive immediately, but they are so hungry for contact from the outside, any contact from the outside. And, of course, people were a little suspicious of me. That was true. And they were actually resistant to certain things at first. But finally, it became, you know, this conduit to another world. And that's what really opened it up. And it was easier in that way for me. I think I had more trouble from the guards, ultimately, than I did from the students, the inmates. And our you know, ultimately, this became a program that went statewide. It was called Free Space Art Without Walls. And we went everywhere in the New York State prisons. So we had a lot of experience doing this, and it was always the same.
What kind of trouble did the guards give you?
Well, the guards don't, you know, again, I'm sure this is still true. I was going to say I'm not sure it's true, but I'm sure it's still true that guards, correction officers, have a really tough job. They have to keep order inside the institution, obviously. They also have to protect people who come in from the outside. And it makes their job manifestly harder to have people coming in who don't know what the deal is. That is to say, you go through civilian orientation, you're taught not to do this, not to do that. You know, you never go anywhere unless there's a guard somewhere in the area. You don't accept anything from inmates. You don't bring them anything. And so they are very suspicious, typically, though this changes too after you go there for a while, and they resist a lot of the traffic of people coming in.
Did you go back to Rikers Island before writing the novel in the hopes that it would kind of enhance your memories of your experiences there?
I did not. I was living in Los Angeles. I moved to Los Angeles in 1983. I came back. I've moved back. I'm now, that dread word, bicoastal, but I actually have not gone back. I'm working right now and trying to start a new program at the only women's prison remaining in Manhattan. It's called Bayview, and I hope to start a poetry writing class there in the fall. But I haven't gone back to Rikers. I think that I've talked to a few people who teach there, so I have a sense of what's going on there, and I've written about it since then, about the suicide rate, which has gone up there, as it has in most prisons, but it's really gone up at Rikers. And so I've kept in touch with what's going on out there, but I haven't been out there. I wanted to say, too, that, you know, I broke rules, too, when I first went into the prison. I had this very, it wasn't really a cavalier attitude, but I had this attitude that, you know, I was a 70s radical. I thought that you could, you know, the establishment couldn't tell you what to do. So when I was told, you're told in civilian orientation before going into prison, you're not supposed to bring in things like pens, ballpoint pens, because the wires, the coiled wires inside, the spiral wires, can be straightened down and made into weapons. Same thing for notebook wire, those spiral wires. Same thing for chewing gum. Impressions of locks could be made, and so on. Candy. I brought all those things in. They, at that time, didn't check very carefully at the different checkpoints. They did randomly search, and I was caught a couple times. But I just thought, well, I can bring this stuff in. I have to have notebooks. The students have to have notebooks. We have to have pens to write, and so on. But I realized later that I was making a mistake by doing that. And there's a scene in which the warden instructs Holly Maddox because of something that's happened, very dramatic incident, that shows how a contraband can really hurt the inmates. And so ultimately one is supposed to work with, in a writing class, with, you know, little rainbow tablets and pencil stubs, and that's what we did.
So you think you were naive in some ways?
I think I was naive. I think, again, I thought I was very political. I thought that I was, you know, I knew better than the Department of Corrections. And there, in some cases, I think that civilians do know better, and they're, you know, when there's a case of clear-cut abuse or something. But in this case, no.
One of the inmates in your novel escapes from Rikers Island. And that character, I believe, is based on a real inmate who was a member of the Black Panther Party in the 70s when you taught at Rikers Island. Was she one of your students?
Yes, she was. Her name was Asada Shakur. She was actually a member of, I'm trying to remember, I think it was called the Black Liberation Army. She had been a Panther, too, as you said, and she was charged with the shootout murder of a New Jersey state trooper on the Turnpike, New Jersey Turnpike. And she claimed her innocence, but before she was brought up on trial, she escaped. Now, she didn't escape from Rikers Island. obviously, I fictionalize a good bit about her, but she escaped from a prison in New Jersey. Nobody knows exactly how, but she got to Cuba, where she is today. And there's $1 million reward out on her head from the families of the New Jersey trooper, state trooper. So she's, you know, she's still wanted. She's written an autobiography called Asada, and she's, you know, a kind of mythic figure.
What was it like for you to know, like, a prisoner who became this kind of, like, mythical story because of her escape?
Well, she was very guarded. She was in the workshop for quite a while, and as I mentioned, the other women began to write more about their own experiences. She did not until towards the end of the time that she was there, and she wrote more about her daughter, who had actually been born while in prison while she was incarcerated, and then of course taken away from her. And she ended up writing very moving, emotional, personal poems, when one would have expected what some of the other women were writing, which were very rhetorical, you know, power to the people kind of poems. So that was an interesting contradiction.
Carol Muskie Dukes is the author of the new novel Channeling Mark Twain. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Uncommon Arrangements, Portraits of Married Life by Katie Royfe. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most, gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark.
Coming up, Brian Ferry tells us why he's recorded an album of Dylan covers, and we listen to tracks from his new CD, Dylan-esque. And we continue our conversation with Carol Muskie Dukes.
Watch out for a simple twist of fate. They walked along by the old canal, so confused I remember well. Stepped into a strange hotel with the neon burning bright. He felt the heat of the night. It hit him like a freight train moving with a simple twist of fate. The saxophones up as far off the plate. She was walking on the arcade. The light burst through a beat of shade, but he was waking up. She dropped a coin into the cup of a blind man at the gate. Forgot about a simple twist of fate.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet and novelist Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new novel, Channeling Mark Twain, is based on her experiences in the 70s when she founded and taught in a creative writing program at the Women's Detention House on Rikers Island. When you were writing your novel, did you ever look back at who you were in 1975 when you started the writing program at Rikers Island and think, oh, she was really naive, or she was really unformed, or she was really whatever. Like, what do you think of that person when you think of her?
Well, yeah, I mean, I said, what I think of that person was that she was a mess and she was naive, but she was very young. I realized that I was, 24, I think, my daughter's age now, and I know now that I was barely conscious in certain ways. But there's a scene in the novel where Holly Maddox, that character, takes up the cause of a woman who has lost her daughter, whose daughter has died, and who wants to go out, be released for her daughter's funeral. And I wrote this character, Holly Maddox, her passion for this woman, woman's cause, in a way that I hope allowed the reader to see that she didn't know how naive she was. And she walks into the warden's office and demands that this woman be released. And then the warden very, very effectively educates her about what really has happened in terms of this woman and the loss of the daughter. It took me a long time to think about that. Even though I learned a great deal at the moment, it took me a long time to think about how to write that scene and understand how truly naive I was, Holly Maddox is, and how that kind of naivete can actually be a damaging force.
What did the warden tell you that showed how naive you were?
Well, in my life, there was a woman who whose daughter had died after she was arrested, and she was arrested with her what turned out to be her pimp. She said it was her baby father. And the baby, her two-year-old, had somehow fallen through the floorboards in her house and had died underneath the house, and the cops hadn't found her. And so this young woman, found out about the baby's death, she said, after she got into Rikers Island, and wanted to be released to be at her funeral. In fact, what had happened, I found out, the warden explained to me, was that this child had been abused for some time, molested by the pimp, the baby father maybe, who had in fact beaten the child to death and then pushed her down under the floorboards of the house, so that the police found the body later. But this woman, who was in love with her pimp, as some of them were, and who was very, very addicted to drugs, claimed that the baby had died naturally, and I believed her.
So did that make you very skeptical of what everybody else was telling you?
No, it made me realize, though, that I had been moved by a poem that this woman wrote. It was a very, I felt, moving poem, a poem of great truth. And see, here we go again. It was a poem of great truth, and it was a poem about, how the system was wrong and how her child had been destroyed by the system. And I was so ripe to believe that. I believed, I had that view of the world. And so when the warden showed me, the coroner's photographs of the child and talked about the pimp and the pimp's record and the woman's drug history and history with the pimp, I realized how naive I had been. And I got it that my political views perhaps needed some retuning. It didn't make me completely cynical because, again, when you're working with people who are writing and they really are expressing themselves as best they can, you have to believe that they are acting earnestly and sincerely, and the workshop won't function unless people trust each other. So I couldn't lose that, and I didn't lose that.
But at the same time, you had to realize that sometimes they'd be writing lies.
Yes, but that's what I said. I understood gradually that to write a lie is as liberating as to write the truth. And after all, you're writing fiction, you're writing poetry, you're creating a reality. This is the imagination at work. It's not therapy, and it's not testimony in court. It's an act of the imagination, and that is different from, quotes, the truth. It's aesthetic or emotional truth, perhaps more real than what we call the facts.
Did you start reading poetry any differently as a result of your teaching experiences?
I mentioned my mother, who was from that last generation of Americans who recited poems by heart, who had learned, in school, how to memorize poetry and to speak it for elocution. And I grew up in the sea of words, my mother reciting poetry, but badly. She would interrupt herself while reciting, for example, let me not to the marriage of true minds, put that down right now, admit impediment. She would talk to her kids and yell at her kids and sort of break into the flow of the poetry. And when I first started going to school, I realized, when I first went to school, I thought that, Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day had something like, don't put your eye out in the middle of it, and kind of felt that Shakespeare had left something out. But so I had always had a kind of skewed, again, here we go with, like, you know, the idea of languages, different languages breaking into each other, you know, the language of my mother's, you know, ongoing life breaking into poetry, and then later the language of the street, how does that break into poetry? So, yes, I mean, I had been sort of, you know, geared by my past to accept the fact that poetry could be rated, you know, the language could be rated midline. And that happened a lot, you know, obviously, when I was working with women in prison, they would use the language of the street and it would alter, you know, they'd start out writing something very formal, and suddenly it would break into, you know, sort of street pattern. So I did start hearing poetry a little bit differently. I'm not sure, that's a whole other discussion. I'm not sure how exactly that affected, you know, how I read it, but I heard it differently.
Well, Carol Muskie Dukes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carol Muskie Dukes is the author of the new novel, Channeling Mark Twain. She founded and is a professor in the graduate program in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. She also teaches at Columbia University. Coming up, Brian Ferry sings Bob Dylan. This is Fresh Air. Since co-founding Roxy Music in the 70s, Brian Ferry has sung a lot of original songs and covers. On a 1973 album of covers, he interpreted a diverse range of songs, including the romantic old pop ballad These Foolish Things, Smokey Robinson's The Tracks of My Tears, Leslie Gore's It's My Party, and Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Now Ferry's done an entire album of Dylan covers called Dylan-esque. Reviewing the album in the Chicago Tribune, Greg Kot wrote, "Ferry isn't just a great singer, but a terrific listener and thinker. His smoothness masks a subversive streak that is essential to great interpretive singing. It's disconcerting to hear the surrealism of Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues played as pop, and stunning to hear the biliousness of Positively Fourth Street channeled into bittersweet regret." Let's start with the opening track of Dylan-esque, Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, which Dylan recorded in 1965 on Highway 61 Revisited.
When you're lost in the rain in Juarez, and it's Easter time too, and your gravity fails and negativity don't pull you through, don't put on any airs when you're down on Rue Morgue Avenue. They got some hungry women there that really make a mess out of you. Now if you see St. Anne, please tell her thanks a lot. I cannot move, my fingers are all in. Strength to get up and take another shot. And my best friend, my doctor, won't even tell me what I've got.
That's Brian Ferry from his new CD, Dylan-esque. Brian Ferry, welcome back to Fresh Air. You first covered Dylan in 1973 on an album of covers that you made. And the song that you chose from Dylan was A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Why did you decide to do a whole album of Dylan songs?
Well, I remember at the time when I was looking for a song for that first solo album, I eventually chose Hard Rain, but there were so many great songs that I was looking at, and I thought, well, you know, one day I must do a whole album of these.
What was your process of figuring out which songs to do?
Well, just songs that reached out to me, really. I mean, songs I had a feeling for. Songs, really, where I loved the lyric. And you know, I love Dylan's lyrics, especially these early songs that he wrote, where they're such a kind of strong imagination there. There's a strong poetic facility. I think he brought a real kind of, for the first time, a real sense of poetry, I think, to you know, songwriting.
You know, some of his lyrics are so elliptical. Like, the words are great. It sounds like great poetry, but who knows what it means? And, like, an example is, like, On Gates of Eden, which you sing. And I, just, like, for anyone who doesn't remember the lyrics, here's one of the more elliptical ones. With a time-rusted compass blade, Aladdin and his lamp sits with utopian hermit monks, side-saddle on the golden calf, and on their promises of paradise you will not hear a laugh except inside the gates of Eden.
You read it very well.
Yes, thanks, right. Sorry for butchering that, but...
I think it's great, that song, because each verse seems to take you off into a kind of a different place and into a kind of surreal landscape. There's like vignettes, you know, different scenes that he creates very beautifully. And I don't really think that you have to analyze every line for it to kind of make sense, but it does kind of put over a very strong kind of sense of unreality, if you see what I mean.
Well, as somebody who loves like pop songs, you know, like one of the songs you recorded was These Foolish Things, you know, a cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, blah, 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 These Foolish Things remind me of you. I mean, that's such a kind of like beautiful images, but really straightforward. Do you love both that kind of straightforward pop song, but also the really elliptical, dense language of Dylan? Did you love it at the time? Were you initially kind of put off by it?
I was never put off by the words. No, I was put off by the instrumentation to begin with. When Dylan was kind of acoustic, I didn't really show a great deal of interest. I mean, I was very much at that time when I first saw people when I was at university, say, wandering around with Dylan albums as they did. I was very much into Otis Redding and all the kind of Stax musicians and R&B, electric guitars, shiny suits. And I was in a completely different place from where Dylan was at that time, I think. It wasn't really until he started playing with a band and, you know, turned electric, as it were, that I sort of got interested in him. And then I became a great fan. And subsequently kind of listened to his earlier albums where he was, you know, just him and a guitar and a harmonica, and discovered what great songs he had there.
You know, one of the things that surprised me about this CD is that what you represent as a singer and songwriter seems so different than what he does. I mean, he's had all these different personas and stuff, but your onstage persona is so different, you know, than his. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're so associated with kind of... being like sophisticated and into high fashion, and you know, a certain amount of like irony, but also like Tin Pan Alley kind of pop, early rock and roll, and Dylan's associated with a certain kind of like seriousness and mysterious, because you never really know who he is. You basically always know like what the persona is that he's embodying at the moment, but it's hard to know like who is the man behind all those different masks. But you seem to like represent two really different kinds of styles. So I just wonder like if you feel any connection to him, like stylistically and in terms of what he represents in music.
Well, I think, you know, there's an earthiness in Dylan which I like very much, which, surprising, I feel, is there in me also. I mean, we both come from kind of, I suppose, what you'd call blue-collar mining areas. Him in the Midwest of America and me in the Northeast of England. So there's a kind of similarity in background, in a way. I think... perhaps in personality, there are some similarities in as much as we were both fairly, I imagine, solitary people. I think he keeps his own counsel, and so do I most of the time.
Well, I want to play another song from your CD, Dylan-esque. And this is Knockin' on Heaven's Door, which was featured in the movie Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And what I really like about your version of it is first of all, just your singing, just the way your voice sounds out on it. And I think you you kind of get a certain chill of death the way you sing it. Do you want to say like why you chose this song and what you wanted to bring to it in your version?
It's a bit of a dangerous one, really, because it's been covered by so many people, but then so has These Foolish Things, you know, or Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, both, you know, two songs from the 1930s that I've covered as well, and were, you know, at significant points in my career. With Heaven's Door, I thought, well, you know, it's a beautiful song, I think, and I thought, well, the Dylan version that I'd heard was very short. I thought, well, maybe I'll do a nice long version where the band can kind of stretch out, and also I just wanted to sing it. And yeah, the words are beautiful, and maybe I was, you know, it is a bit about death, and I've seen it, death, and I thought maybe you know, your experiences sort of do come out, you know, when you are doing a song.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Knocking on Heaven's Door from Brian Ferry's new CD of Dylan songs called Dylan-esque.
And I'ma take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, 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 knocking on heaven's door. Mama put my guns in the ground.
That's Brian Ferry from his new CD, Dylan-esque. It's a whole CD of Dylan songs. Now, your voice has, of course, you know, gotten a little older. And I really like how it's changed. It's changed a little. And it seems, I don't know, you might think I'm crazy, but it seems that there's a kind of emotional connection in some of your singing. I mean, I've always thought of you as having a certain amount of like distance or irony or kind of like existential distance, you know, when you sing. But there's this like emotional connection in your singing now.
Uh-huh, that's interesting. Well, I'm much more comfortable about singing now, both live and on record, than I used to be. And one of the great things about doing this album was that I was singing live with the band, which, you know, on a lot of my albums I haven't done that because maybe the song hasn't been finished when we recorded it, the music part of it. And I say, well, I'll go and write the lyric and come back and sing it later. And so in that sense, it sometimes can be a bit more considered, say, you know. The great thing about doing this Dylan album and other albums where I've kind of been, you know, singing other people's songs, that the song is complete and I just go in there and sing. I like lead from the front at the microphone instead of being in the control room behind the desk, you know. So it's great to be able to be out there leading from the front, as it were.
My guest is Brian Ferry. His new album of Dylan covers is called Dylan-esque. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Brian Ferry. He got his start in the 70s as the lead singer of Roxy Music. His new CD is an album of Dylan covers called Dylan-esque. Well, let's listen to another song from Dylan-esque. And I thought this time we could hear To Make You Feel My Love, which is a more recent song than what we've been listening to. This one's from 1997, from his Time Out of Mind album. Tell us why you chose this one.
I thought, something different here. I thought it was very different from the other songs. It was much simpler. It seemed to be a rather bleak kind of a song of experience rather than innocence. And it just appealed to me. I thought, it's very beautiful, very stark, and kind of sad. There's a real kind of yearning or sense of loss, with sort of feeling that I felt from the early blues singers that I loved, you know.
Well, here's Brian Ferry from his new CD, Dylan-esque.
When the rain is blowing in your face and the whole world is on your case, I could offer you a warm embrace to make you feel my love. When evening shadows and the stars appear, and there is no one out to dry your tears, I could hold you for a million years to make you feel my love. I know you haven't made your mind up yet, but I would never do you wrong. I've known it from the moment that we met, no doubt in my mind where you belong. I would go hungry, I'd go black and blue.
That's Brian Ferry from his new CD, Dylan-esque. Let's talk about what else is happening with you musically. Roxy Music reunited for a tour, and you have a CD that's coming out. Is it next year?
It could be next year or the year after. Mm-hmm. Not really sure, really. It's one of those projects that will probably take a long time because we have other things that we will do. And it's good, you know, because there's a chemistry there. You know, there's a history there, and it's good. Brian Eno came and played with us, although he's not a full part of the band anymore, but it was great to have him come and do something as well. He also did an appearance on this Dylan-esque album as well. He came and played on If Not For You, which ironically is the, I guess, the least Eno song you'd imagine. It's the most pop song, I suppose, out of the set that I chose, and it's great to do something with him again.
Well, why don't we hear If Not For You, which Eno is featured on. What's Eno doing on it?
He didn't do a great deal on it, but sometimes he kind of takes a feed from an instrument and kind of distorts it a bit or fiddles around with it and changes the sound. You know, he did that a lot in Roxy Music with, you know, guitar sounds and saxophone. Whatever. So usually it was kind of lead instruments, but nowadays he quite often does it in a more subtle way with the background instruments. So this time he did it on the drum tracks, and it's a very interesting little sound there.
Let's hear it.
If not for you, babe, I couldn't find the door. I couldn't even see the floor. I'd be sad. If not for you, if not for you, babe, I'd lie awake all night, waiting for the morning light to shine through. If not for you. Thank you.
That's Brian Ferry from his new CD, Dylan-esque. Well, I want to close with another song from Dylan-esque. And I thought we'd close with one of the really famous ones, Positively 4th Street. When Dylan sang this, when he first recorded it, it seemed to be a song, you know, a kind of angry song about all the hypocritical people out there and all the hypocritical friends. Not so much anger when you sing it.
No, I see it as a kind of more of a song of lost love, really. And I think it's nice to bring something new to a song, a different kind of sense to it. And that's the way I read it.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and cheers. Bye.
Brian Ferry's new album of Dylan covers is called Dylan-esque.
You got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend. When I was down, you just stood there grinning.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
You say I let you down. You know it's not like that. If you're so hurt, why then don't you show it? You say you lost your faith, but that's not where it's at. You had no faith to lose, and you know it.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. In stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz pays tribute to opera singer Beverly Sills, who died earlier this week, and we listen back to our interview with her. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.